Hello, this is Dick Hayden, a volunteer reader for the North Carolina Reading Service at ncreadingservice.org. This recording is intended for persons who are blind or have low vision. The reading of this book, Torque Ongana, is for Harrison 2. Torque Ongana, an Armenian fable. Recorded initially by Gazaros Abheyan. Translated by Agop J. Hakikan. And versified by Edward S. Franchuk. This book is published by Gomadas Institute, 42 Blythe Road, London, W140HA, United Kingdom. The year 2007. A note on this version. Translation is always a responsibility and of delight. A particularly daunting task is the translation of poetry, which requires not only rending what the original says, but also trying to capture its tone, intent, and style. This involves a certain amount of interpretation of the original, and in some cases, of rewriting. The intention is not to produce a crib sheet for students of the Armenian language who have been asked to produce a literal translation of parts of this poem, but, in effect, to rewrite the poem as the original poet might have done had he written it in late 20th and early 21st century English, rather than in 19th century Armenian. In translating and verifying this version of the poem, we have retained the structure and shape of the original, except for the use of rhyming couplets throughout. The agglutinative and inflected nature of Armenian facilitates rhyme. The dependence of English on prepositions to perform the same grammatical functions makes it much more difficult to achieve rhyme in a consistently natural manner. We have, therefore, rendered the poem into blank verse. Only occasional use of rhyming couplets where they could be produced naturally and without distorting the sense. Occasionally, line breaks, word order, and sentence sequence have been changed in order to fit the Eastern Armenian original comfortably and naturally into its English garment. It has been a privilege and a joy to produce a version of Torque Ongana in English verse. We like to imagine that Abheyan would have been happy that, so many years after his death, his voice can once again be heard, this time speaking in English and to a worldwide audience. This note is written by Agop J. Hakikan and Edward S. Franchuk. Torque Ongana. Torque Ongana is a legendary Armenian hero or minor deity, the great-grandson of Hayek, according to Movses Kornasti. He was a giant of extraordinary force who could hurl boulders across the seas, flatten the surfaces of rocks, and draw pictures on them with his fingernails. He was apparently called Unga, not beautiful, because of his physical appearance. It is generally assumed, however, that Torque is a combination of two deities who have left traces of themselves in his name. Tarku, the ancient Anatolian deity of fertility, and Unga, a pagan god who was venerated mainly in the province of Unga in southwestern Armenia. Moses Koranatsi also states that he was a prince of that province, hence the references in Armenian history to Ungahatun, the house of Unga. According to this view, the name Torque Ongana means Torque of Ongana rather than Torque the Ugly. It is also interesting to note that in the ancient Armenian translation of the Bible, the name of the Babylonian god Nargal, 4 Kings 17:30, is rendered Unga. And so we begin. Twark Unga and Haikanush the Fair, Prologue. As spring unfolds, it troubles streams and lakes. The mountains and the valleys spring to life as flowers blossom forth in bounteous store. The swallow finds her nest of seasons past. She patches and repairs it, lays new eggs. The frigid snake feels warmth and leaves its pit. The nightingale awaits the rose's bloom. The soil in Gugark rejuvenates. The snow on Loch and Larvar starts to melt. The rivulet in Bognik at daybreak cascades quite hidden in its suds and foam. The Armenian upret, Forest Castle, is furbished and adorned like a new bride. Its turrets flow with tears of restless joy, as though expecting a beloved guest. The mistress of the castle, Haikanush, is slumbering deeply in her dainty bed and dreams of a colossus of a man. She sees a giant with a massive girder borne high upon his broad and mighty shoulder, whose feet, as he approaches where she is, sink deep into the earth he walks upon. He shouts as if in danger, "Haikanush, be thou my love, or kill me with this girder. O hearken to my plea and grant my prayer." The mistress wakes and rises from her bed just as the sun rises from the sea. Her golden locks surround her like a cloud, envelop her fine figure to her feet. A few of her handmaidens then draw near to help their mistress don her shimmering gown, which glimmers with the radiance of her crown. Her recent dream still preys upon her mind. She still recalls the giant whom she saw. "I know," she says, "we'll soon receive a guest, but I'm convinced we should not let him in. Last night I dreamt about a monstrous giant who'll soon be here and fall down at my feet to ask if I'll consent to be his wife." "If truth be known, the giant that you saw," one of her handmaids says, grinning as she speaks, "is just the hero of a lively song. The minstrel sang as you retired last night. His name is Tork Unga of Paskam's kin. According to your minstrel of the Pakhar Mountains, he is most brave shepherd. He is known as Tork. He is both huge and mighty, more giant than a man. He has a gentle heart, despite his ugly face. It doesn't matter if a man is rough-hewn as a chasm, if his heart is soft and fleecy as a lamb. He is most dearly loved by man and beast. Lions and tigers both keep watch upon his flock. He is a member of your race, and even kin, for you and he are both alike in the offspring of one grandfather and his mighty sons. The minstrel's eulogy perturbed your thoughts last night, and so you dreamt about your kinsmen all night long. Be ready, then, no matter what should happen, and help me gird my fabled weapon on. Shut tight the gates of this our forest stronghold, and wash your hair and put on your finest robes. I realize my dream must come to pass, so let's permit our guest to enter, if he will. If he can penetrate through bolted doors, we will have proof our guest is Tork Unga." The giant in her dream was Tork indeed. To have a look at him is what we need. Canto 1, Chapter 1. In times long past in ancient Hayastan, there lived a man whom all called Tork Unga. He was gigantic and an awesome sight, no ordinary man that you can be sure. He had blue eyes clear as the heavenly vault, which shimmered with the radiance of the sun, and over them his pitch-black eyebrows rose, heaped on his brow like somber thunderclouds. His nose was hooked, a veritable hump, his teeth like hatchets, his nails like knives. His chest was thicketed just like a mountainside. His waist resembled most a rocky vale, and his hindquarters seemed a solid beam. In other words, he really was no giant, but a dev. Creatures like him were unknown in those parts. He was ferocious and so very strong that 50 bulls together were no match. While still a lad, he penetrated rocks or took hard stones within his massive fists and crunched them up as if they were just bones, or with his nails scraped smooth their surfaces and formed them into tablets to receive the picture that he then drew with his nails. Torque was a shepherd, tending mountain flocks, a fearless shepherd, not the common sort, where ne'er a lion or tiger came across him, had humbly knelt before him like a hound, thinking he was more a beast than they. They carried out their mighty master's orders and threw themselves in homage at his feet, and oftentimes they begged with plaintive roar that he would toss them a few scraps of meat. He gave them food enough to sate them while they kept a watchful eye upon his flock. Then off he went into the woods himself to search out victuals to sustain his strength. He cut down trees that reached up to the sky and piled them all together to construct a palisade that reached into the stars. A palisade went all around the woods. Like ancient city ramparts it was built, confining all the forest animals, deer, roebuck, hart, and every other beast. He went back to his flock, fatigued and sweating, went with 20 score and 10 of wild beasts on his back. The lions and tigers ran to meet him and threw themselves before the valiant's feet. They greeted Herculean Torque and begged him that they might share in his delicious feast. He was no glutton, like the ravenous Shahara. His favorite foods were yogurt, milk, and honey. And Torque was meek and modest, not a bully. But Lord help those who thought him dim and woolly. Chapter 2. The city people once engaged and enraged our hero. They called him foul and ugly and such names. Unable to contain his wrath, he pulled up a huge tree, and with it he laid flat the entire city. No one inhabitant was spared his ire. And by laid flat, I don't mean simply damaged. The houses, sites, sties, and barns were all destroyed. The people of the city fled like flies. For who would be so bold as to combat with Torque? When they beheld his anger growing blacker, they were agreed that they could not withstand him. Instead, they gave him gifts to calm him down and dance in honor of their mighty foe. The boys and girls all joined their hands together and swayed to the music played to honor Torque. And it is said that after that his face began to look less fearsome, less repellent. Torque was not vengeful, nor was he unskilled. He was a goodly mason and an architect. He leveled hills of stone and brought it to the town that he had destroyed and built it up again. As always, he employed his awesome might to accomplish good and positive results. In former times, our villages and towns were thought fair game by bandits and thieves. But once let Herculean Torque be on the scene, the robbers disappeared into the crowd. He threatened them with neither sword nor arrow. One sight of him sufficed to make them flee. When the enemy had the upper hand, however, Torque used his strength and went on the attack. He lifted heavy stones above his head and dropped them on the heads of the oppressors as persistently as teeming rain or hail. Around the Sea of Pontus, foreign foes from countless ships were pillaging their people. They robbed their houses, then took them as slaves. They also looted hamlets, suburbs, towns, and in broad day abducted pretty maidens. Some of the local people came to Torque for help. They were mainly poor and came from humble stock. When Torque Unga came to the pillage site, the ships had lifted anchor and were under sail, leaving behind the Sea of Pontus ashore. Infuriated, Torque let out a howl. He roared just like a lion hurt or wounded. He picked up rocks and ice the size of hills and threw them at the fast escaping keels. The sea was stirred to turmoil. Waves swirled around. The ships were bounced about like spinning tops. He cast another rock. Another turmoil rose. And boats capsized like tiny shells upon the sea. Another hill, much larger than the first, fell on the foe all unexpectedly, and rocks kept raining down in volleys or alone, hitting ships and causing them to sink. The towering waves that rose from every splash caught the remaining ships and dashed them down, down to the very bottom of the sea. Indeed, from them one man alone survived. When he arrived again on his home shores, a wound upon his head was gaping wide, and he related tales so marvelous that all who heard him stood struck dumb with dread. And that is how, at last, the mighty Torque brought to an end the pirate's dirty work. Chapter 3. Torque's reputation spread both far and wide, and soon was aired in court before the king. The mighty sovereign summoned Torque to court, that he might make him gifts and see his face. And so Torque went to court, and bore upon his shoulders a giant tree, the branches hung with game. Buck, deer, wild lamb, roer, boar, and roebuck too. In preparation for this strange arrival, the royal town's inhabitants had all been warned. When he arrived in town, the shops and stores poured forth horn and trumpet throngs of welcomers. "He's come! He has arrived! Look, look, he's here!" They heralded the news to one another. Both young and old, each woman, maiden, child, had come to see the far-renowned newcomer. When Torque the Titan strode into the city, the people thought he was a moving tower. And it is true, few taller towers exist. He seemed a mighty pile of rough-hewn stones. His stride was leisurely. A tree served as his staff, and each step spanned 4.5 meters. He soon walked through the main door of the palace, surprising everyone, the king included. He humbly placed his staff upon the floor, approached the king, and fell on his knees. Then the king spoke, "May you live long, good Torque. You seem more like an army than a man." Torque bowed his head to kiss the sovereign's ring and to receive the blessing of his king. Chapter 4. The king had heard folk talk of the giant race, were not obedient or very clever. But as he got to know our Torque a little better, he found a worthy courtier in the giant. He kept Torque with him in the palace for 3 months, and had him sit beside him when at table. "Which do you think," the king asked him one day, wishing to test the giant's intelligence, "is better, strength of mind or body?" "Their worth is equal," valiant Torque replied. "Those weak in body might be strong in mind, so it would be a great mistake to think that a weak man is therefore not a danger. But what it is to be intelligent, none knows, and only fools ignore the clever man. A sentry's mind works one way, to be sure, and if successful, the thief must think a different way. But whether he's an idiot or a sage, each man has something in him of the brute. There is one type of wit above all others, though, and that's the wit of heroes and gallants. It's inventive and creative, too. It fills its owner with benevolence and draws him nearer the throne of the Creator. It is the kind of mind that contemplates the elements of earth, air, fire, and water, and finds a way to form from these four basics the tools for plowing and spreading joy, for sowing and tilling, and for harvest. This wit shapes stones and brings forth life, and that, for me, is true intelligence. Without it, man is nothing but a beast armed with a sword." The king was most impressed. He listened, full of wonder, as Torque revealed his cleverness in words and voice of thunder. Chapter 5. The king looked out one day and witnessed Torque, who carried in his hands a hill-sized rock, so easily, it might have been a child. Torque grasped the rock and split it with his fingers, and then used his nails as sharp as chisels to polish it and shape it and hew it and sculpt it. And lo, he had made a statue of the king. It was both beautiful and true to life. It fit its model like a well-made suit of clothes, and everything was in its proper place. It was the very sovereign to perfection. One saw him there in royal robes and cloak, bedecked with jewels and other ornaments. He was seated on his royal throne, His sword was drawn. He wore a crown upon his head and held a fine wrought mace, a symbol of his power. And best of all, the king's majestic beard, with gold and silver pearls, was intertwined. The king beheld and marveled in his mind. Chapter 6. "Torque's an enigma," said the king one day. "This elephant is huge and canny, too. Who would have thought that God endowed this giant with height and mind and also such talent? I wonder, though, if love thrives in his heart. For who in all the world could love a man like him? Among all women living, could one find one who would wish to have him for a husband? It would indeed give rise to a great wonder should such a thing be deemed conceivable, for she would bear him children just like him." And that is what the king was thinking of when he summoned Torque to have a talk with him. "Torque," said the king, "I really don't believe there's any place for love within your heart." At this, our giant glowered, just like an infant, which, hungry, hears the sweet maternal voice say, "Here's my breast, now suck until you're full." The coals of love that glowed within his heart brought color to his face, red as a rose. "My most courageous king," replied our Torque, "if someone said that they had found a beast, a flower, a snake, or a rock that had no breath, I would most surely not be too surprised. But I could never make myself believe that these things exist if they lacked love. The heavens and all below them, earth and sea, the universe itself without love would not be." "You speak as though you loved somebody, Torque. You must have found the woman of your heart." "Where could I find a fitting mate for me? I've yet to meet a woman with a heart that's free. In distant lands, I hear, live women of my size. Before much more time passes, I'd like to set my eyes upon a woman whom I've often seen in dreams, where she awaits me in a deep and lonesome valley, like me. She is unlucky and too much alone, but she is not, as I am, marred and ugly. For she is beautiful, most fair to look upon, like a newborn crimson sun at break of day. What would you like to hear from this most comely maiden? Do you expect that she'd become your wife?" "Yes, in my dream, she promised me she would. She promised me if I met one condition. She said, if you can find and vanquish me, you may be sure I'll wed you right away. But I've no inkling where to look for her, so I can neither fight, defeat, nor wed her." "Do not despair. I'll summon my Beshkas and order them to locate your fair maiden." Torque was ecstatic, but embarrassed too. And he sat there blushing, red as any child. He humbly kissed the knee of his liege lord and took his leave as soon as he could. The king himself was in a merry mood. The secrets of the giant's heart had been unglued. Chapter 7. As he had said, the king called for the princes, who were then staying at the palace, as it chanced. "I wish to know," he said, "about the many peoples who live within the borders of our kingdom. Can there be found among them any giants, for instance, any Torques, both strong and trenchant?" The king was not familiar with the land because he had been born on foreign soil. The first to give his answer was Aaron, who was the esteemed and mighty prince of Bog. "Long live the king," he said, and then made this statement. "There do indeed survive within our borders gargantuan men who live quite close to us. They make their homes in rocky crevices, dark hidden valleys, and sequestered places, where they have gone in order to stay free and to avoid paying all of the taxes. The clerks and elders of our villages get nothing from them but a few loud roars. They build their homes beneath the valley floors, but making use of neither wood nor stone. Upon the level ground, all one can see is rising smoke from 40 different sources, a sight hard to explain. What could it be? No one would ever guess it was a village. You search and find a door and venture in. 40 or 60 giant men are there, all throwing tree-sized logs into the fire, and sitting with long faces round the hearth, an ancient giantess, who seems to be their mother. positions a stone cauldron o'er the flames, in which wild boars are being boiled alive. So she prepares her stew and stirs it with a pole instead of with a ladle, as our women do. The house has countless caverns, in which live the brides of all the sons and other maidens, and all of them are big, nay, all enormous, both men and women, little girls and boys. They are not coarse like torque, nor so unpolished, but very beautiful and well-bred, too. What Prince Aran is saying is all true. The Prince of Gorgarine took up the tale. For giants also fled to our own valleys in order to escape the tax collectors. If but the voice of a village clerk is heard, they melt away as the snow does in the spring. They seem to shrink in size and disappear. Our elders cannot catch a single one. Their own communities have neither clerks nor elders. That's how they stay so prosperous and huge. However, do they manage without money? Inquired the monarch of the Prince of Lore. Well, for money is essential to survival. They surely need to buy both food and clothes. They are skilled in making plows and farm the land. They have pigs and sheep and herds to milk and yoke, and cotton, flax for linen, and silkworms. They manufacture dyes, get crimson from the insects. Their women spin and make thread and dyes and knit and wear the clothes they make themselves. The effect is exquisite. They make the clothes for every family member. And don't forget clothes for their relatives. They're skilled in weaving, carpets, shawls, and garments. No item is too large or small for them. They have cows and goats, which give them cream and butter. They have fruit and seeds and cereal, beets and flour. They drink from ice-cold springs as clear as crystal rivers that flow within their chasms and ravines. They're skilled in surgery and remedies and know the recipes for medicines. If ever there is anything they lack or need, they soon obtain that thing through bartering. They don't partake of either wine or ogai. They are free of all addictions and live long. Indeed, it seems no member of their race has ever suffered ailment or disease. They're all so healthy that they look like children, united and attached by lasting love. They sacrifice themselves for one another. They are hospitable and generous, fond of tradition too, and virtuous. How can these giants be of use to us if they refuse to pay the tax collector? They shun their taxes, but all are brave fighters, and they're always ready to defend their country's honor. They have an arsenal of arrows, slings, and crossbows, and go to war as to a wedding feast. Their favorite strategy is showering their opponents with arrows from their crossbows and with stones. And if perchance it happens that no weapons lie to hand, they use their superhuman strength in unarmed combat. Just one of them is strong enough to go against 100. In consequence, 1,000 foes can be put down by 10. Like hungry wolves, they fall on them and they don't have a chance. If what you say is true, leave them alone. Exempt these giants from tax collection. But, said the king, this freedom has a price. For Torque, our titan, they must find a bride. That's very hard, the prince said in reply. Perhaps they will agree to your condition, but they would never give one of their daughters in marriage with no test of skill by which the bridegroom proved himself a worthy husband. They have a contest, and the winner takes the bride. Moreover, this is not the end, far from it. For next, the bridegroom must take on the bride and if it proves he cannot vanquish her, the woman will consider him no longer. What you have told me, Torque saw in his dream, the king said with a grin when he finished. It's clear our titan Torque must venture forth. Go there and test his giant strength and what it is worth. Canto number 2, chapter 1. O heavenly love, you ancient comforter, endow my soul with wings and let me fly. Enable me to draw your angelic, charming image with feeble mortal tools, my brush and pen. Hey, Kanush and Torque, now there's a couple. But love is blind, they say, without discrimination. A lover slipped, got covered in manure, but his beloved seemed to take no notice. And there are many tales of lions, bears, and snakes, and jackals, and eagles, even crows sometimes, and beasts of every manner of description, that have through their enchantments won fair maidens, whom they carry to their caverns as their brides. One has to mention, though, that in such tales, the beasts are often soon changed into humans. True love gives back to the bewitched lover the true appearance he once had and lost. What had seemed birds and snakes and forest creatures receive anew their former human shapes. For beauty, like the sun, enlightens gloomy places, but love acts otherwise. It sends its spark to ignite the torch that is hidden deep within, illuminates the inner world, ignores the outer. The heart becomes articulate, the tongue falls mute. The lover is possessed by dreams and reverie, which revel in the chambers of his brain. The heart in love has lost contact with earth and flies away into the airy sky. The glorious wings of romance lifted high. Chapter 2. The year had now rolled round to summertime. The summit of Loch Mountain is now prepared a paradise for its inhabitants, and sounds of gaiety were heard on every side. Along with innocent celestial love and endearments, the multiple colored and sweet-scented flowers are all bent and greeted one another with a dainty kiss, and numerous fountains, pure and crystalline, embraced each other as they raced into the dale. The shepherd's flute sang but one song, love, love, and all the young fawns frolicked, young lambs leapt. Upon the summit of the mountain stood a giant who had come here from afar. He was none other than the mammoth Torque. The giant looked upon a splendid wide horizon. Wide is the word. It was 10,000 miles in length. His feet were planted on colossal heights. Below him, there were countless mounds, namelessly planted. It was the great Caucasian mountain range, and it looked just like a leviathan stretched on the shore, bending its head to drink from the Pontus Sea, while stirring up the Caspian with its tail. Between the peaks at either end, it formed a towering screen, just like a chain of diamonds, which separated northern lands from southern. Torque saw the sun reflected in the Caspian Sea, with splendor as it arose out of the waves, and showered with its early radiance the stretched-out body of the leviathan. What a majestic sight! How grandiose! Enthralled, the enormous exiled traveler sat, and let his mind reflect on what he saw. He dropped upon his knees before the sun and said a prayer in his booming tones, which echoed in the valleys from the mountain's stones. Chapter 3. A shepherd with no crook, but a princely staff, drew near to Torque and asked what was the matter. Colossal giant, tell me who you are and whom you call upon in such an awesome voice. I am a stranger here, replied the giant, a wanderer, and I am lost, I fear. What land is this that spread out before us? What towns are these that dot the vales and the summits? To tell the truth, I don't know all their names, but with his staff he pointed out to Torque some of the scattered towns and gave their names. That one is Genshek, the other Moshavin, and that one there, which seems sunk in the valley, is Sertav, which is famous for its vineyards. And over there is the fortress of Upret. The owner is an orphan of great beauty, a comely maiden loved by one and all. What is her name? Who is she? Asked the giant. Her name is Haikunush, and she is called the Fair, and she excels in beauty and attraction. Yet no one yet born is nearly so enchanting. There is no other like her, and she is friendly, too. And she has scarcely lived for 10 springtimes in 8. You say she is an orphan with no relatives? The lovelorn giant uttered with compassion. The prince dispatched her parents to Gajenk. There they died there, or at least did not return. Is there a chance they still live in Gajenk? I doubt they're living still, unless in heaven. You mean they are deceased and live no more? If they have not returned, they are as good as dead. If folk once turn their backs upon our mountain and depart, they are punished by the sun which bars them all from the mountain, and they never can return. Who then takes care of this enchanting maiden? Is she looked after by her kinsmen and by others? No, it is she who takes good care of others, of everyone in need and those who mourn. Her house is filled with maids and countless servants, and she has many dogs and several flocks. She is a giant, but unlike you, she is comely. She is both tall and slender, and she is strong. No other giant's half so beautiful, or half so strong, as is our Heikhonush. If this be true, why, then, is she not married? She cannot find a husband who is worthy. They say one day a giant from a distant land will show up suddenly and seek her hand. Such was the message of the traveling troubadour. Heikhonush awaits her destiny. Torque's heart was moved and his face animated. He knew the giant foretold by the strongster could be none other than his exiled self. The man is lucky, added the young shepherd, who wins the hand of Heikhonush in marriage. She is both merciful and open-handed, and has no rivals in her noble lineage. She gives a harness to whoever lacks one, and if some needy farmer has no plow, she sends a plow drawn from a team of oxen. And all year round she hands out cheese and eggs to nourish those who lack enough to eat. I beg of you to tell me, said the giant, what is the shortest road to Ypres Castle? Well, if you continue straight along this way, you'll reach the castle gate by noon of day. Chapter 4. Noontime had almost come. Time, then, to eat, to take care of what the stomach needs. And Heikhonush had laid out tasty dishes, some savory kebabs and delicious fishes, and she wished a visitor would come to eat, one such especially, the giant of her dream, when, hark, someone was knocking at the fortress gate, a giant from the sound of the great blows. He banged upon the gate and banged again. The gate stayed shut. His knocking was in vain. It seemed a trick was being played on him. Keep quiet, please, and don't go to the door, the mistress said. But what on earth was that? The giant firmly grasped the iron gate and folded it just like a paper fan, laid it aside and started up the steps of stone. Now stamping like a child his mother has denied him, now tottering like a half-starved, feeble beggar. The servants waiting on the upper landing took one good look at Torque and fled in fear. Why are you frightened? Calmly asked the mistress. Where are your manners? Ask our guests to enter. Is this not Torque, the giant from Pascam? For surely no one else would have the nerve to smash my iron gate without a thought. Torque answered these remarks of Heikhonush. It is clear they could not know that I am Torque Unga, or they would not have shut the gate right in my face. Or was it your intention to play games? If so, you must accept the consequence. I'll go now and repair the castle gate, and put the bolt back as it was before. So Torque went out and soon restored the gate, and all who saw it wondered at the sight. It had been old and rusty, and now it glittered as if he were not made of iron, but of silver. Then he returned and sat down as before, while Heikhonush stared at him lovingly. Why keep your distance, sitting on that stone? Join us at our table. Share our salt and bread. You've traveled far. You must wish to be fed. Yes, indeed, I am famished, really starved. The giant heaved a sigh and then continued, what can you give me that will fill me up? And water, please, I am so very thirsty. But I must tell you that no bread and water can satisfy me but your love, fair maid. I know that I'm rough-looking, but no matter, beneath my coarse outside, there beats a tender heart, so large it has enshrined you head to toe. I am prepared to fall down at your feet. Give me your heart, or if not, kill me quick. This is no time for such discussion, said the mistress. Tend to your stomach first. Your heart can wait. I am your humble slave, and I await your orders. Attach me by a chain to guard your door, and I'll protect you like a faithful hound. You'll see. The light of my own eyes will not be dearer, and I'll make sure no danger threatens you. I'm sure you can protect me from most dangers, but who would then protect me from your claws? When she had said these words, both Twerk and Hey Kanoush laughed loud and long. It seemed they would not stop, as though they had been friends from childhood. Then they began to feed, but took no food. Chapter 5. Twerk loved her most sincerely, loved her dearly. He loved her with a love both pure and manly. And in the dark, his ugly face was changed by the light that radiated from his heart. Before, his rude appearance and grim gaze had petrified whoever came across him. But now his eyes were crystal, like a fountain, and out of them poured love and tenderness. Behold his gentle smile, his lively grace. Who was it that said he had a monstrous face? Chapter 6. Whene'er the fire is burning with a blaze, those who are hot are forced to move away. When the barnyard rooster crows the whole long day, the hens all flee and hide to get some peace. Now Twerk was warbling like a nightingale all day, but Hey Kanoush was quiet like a rose in May. Yes, no, perhaps. These were her only words. She used but little speech to hide confusing thoughts, or perhaps it was prudence of her sex that made her keep her tongue sheathed like a sword. At last she spoke to Twerk, although confessing, "If you would win me, this is not the way. Despite your strength, the proof of which I've seen, you have to beat me in a duel, don't forget. I know your fingernails can pierce like a saber, but I've a sword as piercing as your nails. There never was a giant I could not outduel, or he powerful lout like you or cruel." "My enchanting Hey Kanoush," replied the giant, "enough of this. Don't make me lose my mind. Don't get me wrong. I'm frightened of no sword, whether sent from heaven or from down below. But tell me this, how could I ever dare to raise my rough brute hand against one so fair? I am your slave, prostrate beneath your feet. Ask me instead to battle with a fleet, 100 or 1,000, 10,000 if you like, of mighty valiant warriors, or maybe even demons. Order me to relocate a mountain, or even raise a forest to the ground, to divert a surging river from its course, or push these mountains there, right here, and make this valley wider. I can crush the highest peaks with one blow of my fist, but I never could touch my precious Hey Kanoush. If that's the case, go fetch me 20 giants from Dozoropur, that's where they live in caves, all titans who can rival you in size. If you can capture 20 of these giants and bring them back, you'll save my reputation. But if you can't, you know what folk will say. Their wagging tongues will dance with idle gossip, saying I was kidnapped by a stranger, a wild, unkempt, unmannered mountain